ladies and gentlemen, we're live here at the Canadian Bowler Podcast. It's Mike, joined by my beautiful co-host, Daryl. How's it going, Daryl?
That's going good, Mike. Beautiful day, beautiful week. Glad to be back.
You look a little suntan over there. A little bit of a suntan going on. I think you've been in the sun or something.
I think I've got the lawn bowler's tan going on, so I've got some, just looking at the monitor. Some lines, some nice crisp lines as usual, you know, the sock tan and all that great stuff, but it's bowl season, so it's about time I got out in the sun for once.
Yeah, you gotta get your base tan going, the prerequisite lawn bowler farmer's tan, whatever you want to call it, where you have the nice shirt line and probably a good sock line. You gotta get that base in early or it's sunburned city.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, before we get going, just a reminder, if you're here joining us, to hit the like, comment, subscribe button there. We appreciate any sort of interaction we can get. Anything that you really bring in the chat or comments on the video really do help us out creating content in the future. If you aren't able to get us live, the video is usually posted to YouTube within the day, so you're able to catch it after the fact if you want to watch the show after we're going here live. And then if you are a podcaster, we do have the show on podcast platforms, usually within about a week. So whatever major podcast platform should be available there within the next week. So I guess if we want to jump into it, the big news sort of alluded to it. We had the Canadian national team camp would have just wrapped up yesterday or the day before. You would know better than me because you were there. So they had that and Daryl was there all week. So I guess Daryl probably give us a little bit of an insight how that went.
Oh yeah, good camp. It was really great to see everybody after 2+ years of not seeing them and kind of just getting tidbits of what's going on in their lives from all over Canada and around the world. We had everybody over from overseas as well, which was really, really cool. A lot of players in Canada, you know, because some of those players have been over for a few years, haven't really met them in person. So, you know, meeting a Ryan Bester or a Kelly or a Leanne who have been over there for a long time is really, was really, really special for a lot of players, I think. And it was good to get everybody together. As far as the camp goes, it was a grueling bunch of days. I know my days, I was usually, you know, wide awake at, you know, 5:45, and I didn't probably go to bed until, you know, 11, 12 at night. And then back up and doing the same thing over and over again, you know, trying to manage COVID stuff and meals and playing and making sure everybody got a fair chance to show their stuff and get the selectors around to see everybody. It was a pretty hectic week, but I think it went really well. We've got a few more days, probably a week of chats and note transcription into a better format, because I know I've got a book here full of notes and all that kind of stuff, which is all scribbles all over the place. So putting that into some coherent a thing that people can actually read and understand will be fun. But really interesting. Selection camp is always tough. I prefer to do those things as a training camp. So, you know, myself as a coach, being a selector there, not interacting with them as a coach per se, and just kind of, you know, watching them and observing. And even if I saw some good or some bad things or some things that were questionable, not being able to jump there as a coach and kind of use it as a teaching moment was really difficult for me. And I'm sure players would have really liked to get more instant feedback from everybody. Tammy and Derek were there as regional coaches, which was awesome. Tammy's first time there. Dealing with national team athletes, I think she took a ton away from it, which was really, really cool. But they were working with teams, so there was still a whole bunch of other games going on. So really good, really cool. I'm sure everybody's going to be interested to see what the teams are coming out. I have no idea. You know, I'm working with the two other selectors that were there. Unfortunately, Terry Scott wasn't able to come. Paperwork was delayed through the government, and you know, as time ticked on, they weren't able to catch up, so he wasn't able to actually make it. So we did virtual meetings with him every single night. Tough for him because it's really early in the morning when it's really late at night here. So we made it work. We got things done, and I think it was a really successful camp. But I'm sure when the names come out, whoever the five are, and the men and the women, everybody and their uncle will have an opinion about it. So I'm looking forward to seeing that too.
Yeah, I guess if you're talking about your getting up 5:15 a.m. or whatever it was and going to sleep at 11:12, that kind of makes sense if you're maybe having to video chat with Terry on the other side of the world. So I guess those times, but part of the life of being a coach or a selector, whatever you want to call it, I totally understand where there's a lot of background work you guys would have to do. So it makes sense to me. It's like, what was the sort of the format of the camp? Was it more you guys did like lots of games, or was it more like training and drills, or was it kind of a combo of everything?
The first day we kind of used as a acclimation day. So players could get there, they could use the morning to roll a bunch of bowls, do whatever they wanted to get themselves kind of used to what the surface at Windsor was going to be like, because it was going to be slower, especially for those coming overseas. It was going to be really slow compared to what they've been bowling on. We had Tammy and Derek run some drills at some point to try to get a little structure involved in it. And after the first day, we then moved to match play. So Terry would put together teams based on sort of the matchups he wanted to see, people and positions he wanted to see, whether you're playing singles, fours, triples, or pairs, that kind of stuff as well. And then as the days went on, we would have discussions at night to say, okay, you know, we've seen this player a ton at skip, or we've seen this player a ton at lead. Let's see what other combinations we can make up. Or maybe there was someone that hadn't played a position yet, and we were kind of like, oh, you know what, we've gone through the list and we haven't seen this person, so let's mix it up. So the last couple of days we're trying to get everybody in different positions, see some different looks, and get as much information as we could, really. It's tough. I mean, there's a ton of people that want to be selectors, and there's a bunch of armchair selectors. I can tell you, having done it a couple times now, it sucks. I'm just going to say it. There's people that are probably geared towards it and love being a selector. I can say from my perspective, looking at players and seeing their strengths and weaknesses, and trying to figure out like a good combination and team and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, I know all these people. They're all good people. And having to tell them they were selected or not selected, and give them feedback as to why, or possibly what during the week didn't go in their favor, those are tough, and it sucks. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It sucks giving that information.
Might have to get you watching that Moneyball scene where Jonah Hill has to cut Carlos Pena to sort of help you with those moments in the future, because I know that's the one that I always think of whenever I kind of hear those personal moments. Like I know, just even from like working and jobs that I've had to do, I've had to give tough news to people and stuff like that before. So I don't envy you with that part of it where you're having to say, well, this didn't go well for you, or whatever it is type of thing. But that scene always, I relate to it, because the Billy Bean or Brad Pitt's character, whoever, just says to him, just go to the point, get to the point, make it not personal. And that's just right. As much as it is a personal thing, or be taken personal, I can see why you'd want to almost remove yourself from the personal side of it. It's more of a business or a team decision type of thing.
Yeah, it's I'm sure some people are geared towards that and love doing that kind of stuff, but for me, it's always a really, really tough time. But yeah, the camp went well.
It's like looking at the pictures, it looked like you guys had pretty good weather, and well, then you got a little bit of a tan going, so you had pretty warm temperatures, it looked like. And yeah, there we go, like the sun. So it's what, middle of May in Ontario, so probably decent temperature wise which you can't really complain about.
Yeah, the temperature was awesome. The yeah, there's the dream team right there, you know. Players really enjoyed it. I mean, we lucked out, there was no rain, no really bad weather, it was all sunny. So Yeah, a lot of players were got burnt. If they're like me, they haven't seen the light of day in, 2 years. I know I tried to stay in shade as much as possible, and I still got a little pink, which was pretty incredible. But yeah, good team, good day, good days. Everybody got along, everybody chatted. It was really quite just a fun event, despite it being so critical to these players that they do well to be selected.
So I guess burning questions some people might have. Canada, early May, you said the greens were pretty slow. Like what would you gauge the sort of green speed there?
10, 11 seconds. I don't know for sure how fast they got as the days went on, because it did get really hot, and it was really sunny. But they did try to water them a little bit to keep them at that speed and keep the keep it relatively the same. But I would average probably 10, 11 seconds, so not bad.
Okay. Yeah, probably pretty comparable to whatever they're going to experience this summer in Birmingham. So that's probably a good quality control almost too, because maybe a slightly faster 11, 12 is probably around the range of what you're going to see in England. So good
Absolutely.
call. So I guess we can kind of segue from that to pretty early season across Canada in general. I know a lot of places are, well, Ontario specifically, you guys are able to bowl, and I think BC, Saskatchewan, and lots of places are having open houses. It's probably questionable if you can bowl all that much or all that well at this point, but it is kind of that beginning of the season. So, anything you've been doing or that you would recommend for people sort of starting out, getting ready to maybe go out and throw some bowls on those ultra heavy greens are getting themselves ready for provincials, maybe month out or something like that.
Yeah, we've got some videos out there of delivery and skill assessment for that early morning stuff. Make sure you check out our YouTube channel for coaching videos, and we'll be releasing more as we go on. But for early season, it's really getting out there and taking stock of what's happened over the last 2 years, right? Roll some bowls. Don't just go out there and huck bowls down the green. Set some targets at ultra short and ultra long, and just see how you do. Are you having trouble getting it down the green because it's so heavy? Are you having to really rip it? That kind of stuff. Really, just maybe not a skills assessment, but just take stock of where you're at. Do things feel okay? Is your delivery got any weird quirks that have worked their way in over the years because you haven't really been competing and really thinking about it? Really, it's just shaking off the rust a little bit and getting out there and rolling bowls, and just gauge where you're at and really trying to pinpoint where you need to put in the work.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And honestly, if you're, I guess, even talking to the coaches that maybe you're listening, that's probably something you can say to them too, is give the person they're coaching drills to go out there and sort of assess how things have gone over the last couple of years, or even have a sit down and talk with the person you're coaching to see how the things have gone over the last few years. Because as you're saying, I really do think a lot of people are probably going to get out there in the next month, and there's going to be lots of little quirks or things that they haven't realized that have happened over the last 2 years of inactivity that they might have to work on or sort of refine out of their game. So it could actually be a little bit of a thing where you may want to go out there, do some practicing pretty early in the year here, and just see if everything is still the same, feels good. And maybe if you have a coach with you, make sure it looks good and that everything is kind of doing what you're wanting it to do.
Absolutely. It's tough getting out there early season. I mean, the greens are not always in the best condition, especially all around Canada. There's going to be clubs that are awesome. Like Windsor was really well ahead of any other club that I saw. Their greens looked like really well maintained. They were cutting them every day. So I'm sure that they'll be in prime condition a lot earlier than most greens around Canada. But if you're in a club that struggles and you got really, really slow greens, sub 10 seconds, sometimes it can be hard to do those assessments really early in the year. But really, just get out there, shake off that rust, throw a lot of bowls, get that comfort level back and really, yeah, just take stock of where you're at. You know, is your delivery doing what you want it to do? Are you hitting your lines? Are you hitting your weight? And hopefully from there, you can just make a plan to work out the kinks, work on some of those shots, and hopefully we'll be off and running when the provincial playdowns start coming around.
Yeah, we got a torrential downpours on Thursday, Friday this week. So our greens were flooded on our open house yesterday. So I was helping coach there, and I think my first game would be on Tuesday. We have a competitive league that they do early in the season here. So that'll be fun to jump out there and throw my first bowl. And I'm, as you're saying, sub 9 seconds is probably what I'm expecting. So we'll see how it goes and see if I can identify some kinks or some things to work on, because I do like to practice every once in a while. So probably we'll have to pick out some stuff to maybe put some work in on once I do have that game there on Tuesday.
At the end of the day, if you're hitting some of those really, really slow greens, sometimes, you know, the only thing you can do is grip it and rip it and hope for the best, right? Like you play with what you can, and you make do with what you can. And hopefully as the season goes on, it'll just get better and better.
Okay. Well, we do have an interview coming in here today. I guess in between now and when we recorded the interview, actually there was some news with this individual. So John Rednall is who we have here for an interview coming up here on the show. John is a longtime England international, involved with coaching, lots of involvement in bowls across England. He's a writer for Bowls International magazine. So he's a very big name, I guess, there in England specifically. He's quite influential over there. And in between when we recorded the interview and now, he actually announced his, retirement from the England national team. So that was a bit of a development from the last time we spoke with him. But all the best to him in the future there. I guess bringing in the video there, Daryl.
All right, here we go.
Perfect. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Canadian Bowler Show. I'm Michael Petulli, today joined by Daryl Fitzgerald, and we have a special guest with us today, John Rednall. Thanks for joining us, John.
That's my pleasure. Good to see you, Daryl and Michael.
So the one thing we like to do whenever we start out an interview is essentially give you the floor, sort of allow you to explain who you are and sort of how you relate to bowls. So the floor is yours, John.
Okay, well, I'm John Rednall, and I started bowling competitively at the age of 14. Although I was a frustrated 14-year-old because I'd actually wanted to play before that. And in those days, the age limit in England was 14. And I'd wanted to play a lot sooner, probably, you know, age seven was when I really wanted to. But my parents were both bowlers, my grandparents as well. And started at a club in Stowmarket where I live now, which is the Rookery Bowling Club. And my father had been secretary and president and things like that. So learned to play on what they called the turf bed, which was just the spare bit of grass in the corner, and collected up the pensioners' bowls, and didn't have a set of my own at that time. And I used to play on there. And then at the age of 14, started to play legally, if you like. Started to play indoors when I was 16. And got into the England team when I was 23. So county team at 17. Luckily won a couple of national and a British Isles title and got into the what was a brilliant England team at that time at 23 years old. And I was the youngest. Now I'm the oldest.
I can probably make a list of all the people that you've played with. Some of the best of the best from England, Tony Alcock, David Bryant, John Bell, just to name a few. And you've played at the highest level in England and internationally. Do you have any particular one highlight that stands out as something that you just cherish?
Yeah, I think the most cherished highlight, Daryl, really was the England debut, which I guess a lot of people would say. And I was very fortunate. I was selected with the great David Bryant. And this was in the International Series of 1987 in Llanelli in Wales. And I suppose a cherished moment really was the fact that David Bryant really did look after me. You know, I think he realised that I was a nervous newcomer. And I'd met David, strangely enough, when I was 9 years old. My birthday present was to go and watch David Bryant playing in an indoor national championships. And I spoke to him then and got his autograph at age nine. And then I played against him at the Preston Guildhall in the UK singles in 1985 and was lucky enough to win on that occasion. And so I knew David already, but he was great. We were we didn't have a team bus in those days, and he offered to drive me to Stradley Park, Llanelli, for the first match. And so we got into his car and had a chat about, you know, international bowls and things. And then he said, right, we'll go for a walk around the park. And I think it was just really to relax me. And he was actually number three in a ring skipped by David Ward, who I played indoors and outdoors in the England team with for many years, probably over 60 games, I think. And David was a really calm, cool customer. He was a bomb disposal officer in real life, just as cool on the bowler's green. And our trademark really was we never played the same mat position or jack length twice. And it was a Leeds nightmare. You know, people used to say, how on earth do you lead for this guy? You know, we'd have the mat up to the minimum distance mark one end and full length the next, and, you know, mat back and short the next. And never played the same distance twice. So David was a skip. And then the number two in that rink was an ex-Bristol City footballer called Peter McCall. And I hadn't met Peter before, but it was a great rink to play in. So, yeah, you know, that was a fantastic debut in probably just the rink that I would choose to go into, I think.
It's amazing.
That's a fun story to get there, sort of the debut and just the names involved and everything. I imagine that would have been a fun experience. When we're talking about your experiences, so you're the first player outside of North America that we've interviewed that's actually played bowls in Canada. So you were on English team that was at the 1994 Commonwealth Games in Victoria. Yeah. So how was your experience at the Commonwealth Games in Victoria?
Well, I played with John Bell, who you just mentioned. The number two in the fours was my club mate from Ipswich, Roy Cutts. And Wyn Richards, the great Wyn Richards, the Welsh Englishman, was number three in the fours. And I mean, I loved every moment of it because I'm not just a bowler. You know, I do a lot of running. I love sport in general. It was an opportunity to be a huge multi-sports event with people that I'd just seen on the television, you know, the likes of Linford Christie and Denise Lewis and Diane Modal. We just had the Athletes Village at Victoria University, and we had day trips out. We had a trip to Souk, I remember. Does that ring a bell? The sort of First Nations village.
Yep, yeah,
and
yep.
And various sort of day trips as a whole team, which was just an eye-opener, you know, to be on the same bus as, you know, the runners and the weightlifters and the shot putters. And, you know, it was just fantastic. And I used to go out jogging in the morning, and I'd be jogging, you know, down the same road as people that were real runners. So that was great. Yeah, just loved the whole experience. And the Commonwealth Games, I suppose, was different then in that the bowls was full-length games. I think we played full 21 ends of, and I think we played 10 matches in the group.
Wow.
And we finished third. I think we needed to win the last game from memory against Zimbabwe to get into medal positions. And Zimbabwe just played brilliantly. And we didn't make it. But the whole experience, I loved the area. I loved the wildlife. I mean, we saw orcas and, you know, and all the sorts of things that I hoped that I would see. So it wasn't just the bowls that I loved. It was the whole Commonwealth Games experience, really.
That's awesome. The club is still going strong. You can see the remnants of all the Commonwealth Games stuff still around there. So it's really neat to see, for sure.
It was so well done, and you know, you could flag down the taxis, and there was the Kleewick mascot and all the badges that you could collect. And I look back on it now, I think I've still got the Commonwealth Games blazer and the shell suit, which is pretty out of date now, but yeah, things that you don't part with.
Absolutely. So your daughter Catherine came on the show and did an interview with us, which was awesome.
Yeah, I watched that. Yeah,
she's been one of the top bowlers on the World Bowls Tour for some time now, and she's also one of the most decorated women bowlers to play in the WBT. What is it like having your daughter, knowing that you've excelled in bowls, seeing her just excel in that sport too?
Yeah, I think like any proud parent, you know, it's what you always hope for. And the chances were that, you know, I suppose the chances were that she would play bowls. But she came along to the junior bowlers classes that I held at Ipswich and District Indoor Bowling Club. I did that for about 14 years, and Catherine came along really just to watch to start with. And at the age of, I don't know whether she was 5 or 6, but she came onto Rink One, Indoor Green, and said, could she have a go? And her first delivery was just like somebody that had been playing for years. And she was quite petite, quite diminutive. And the furthest that she could get, even with small bowls, was a sort of minimum length jack mark, a 23-meter mark. But it wasn't long, really, until she got the more strength and the timing, which was crucial. And after that, you know, sort of age 7, age 8, she was playing full-length jacks indoors without any problem at all. And, you know, I think I'd have been overjoyed if Catherine had been, you know, a champion in any sport or enjoyed any sport. I know she had golf lessons at one time. She played junior football at one time. But I suppose with the background of having grandparents and family and everything, it was fairly inevitable that she would go into bowls. But the early progress was just fantastic with her. You know, she was never a bad bowler right from the start. She could play. And somebody said to me when, I think she was about 14, 15, how good do you think she can be? What's her potential? And I said, I truly think she'll be a world champion, which is a brave call. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a biased call because that's what every parent hopes for. But no, she certainly fulfilled that potential. And she's still getting better.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a bold prediction, but you definitely must be a bit of a psychic or something because you're on the mark with that.
Well, I think I've taught hundreds of children to play bowls, and a lot of them have gone on to enjoy it and do well and play at county level and even under 25 level are the ones that I've taught. And Mark Royal was one of mine as well. He came to junior sessions when he was 12 years old, and Mark's done really well. And I've got a young lad now at my club called Charlie Beaton, and he is probably the... I think he shows the greatest potential to be an international or future world champion. So just remember that name. He's brilliant. He's only 15 and he's fantastic already.
Wow.
So you do touch on, you have touched on it, that you're sort of a junior coach. So Bowls England Junior Academy coach. What exactly do you do in that role?
Well, I did that for 3 years, and it was something that I felt very privileged to do. And I'd often wondered what happened at the Bowls England Junior Academy. And they'd heard that I'd done some sort of local and regional junior bowls. And that I suppose it came as a sort of thing from being a school teacher. It was a natural kind of progression. And I'd actually been a qualified coach since 1985. So I was very young when I became a coach. But I think what we did at the academy was lots of things that are actually current now that I've done when I coached the Commonwealth Games squad a few months ago, and it's things like the warm ups, the stretches, the coordination exercises that I do with the kids at the academy, and I always try and get their parents involved as well. So we do them on the green, but we do them on the end rink, and say, you know, it would be great if the parents joined in as well. And then things like working on their delivery actions, their technique, without being too prescriptive, but just, you know, if they come to you and say, you know, I've got a preference for my backhand or whatever, and I'll say, well, why? And we'll try and analyze it and watch them. And then also the educational kind of psychology side as well, of saying, what are your aspirations as juniors? Who are the role models? Who are your heroes in the sport? Who's helped you most at your club and so far in your career? Who's helped you? How have they helped you? And we're very lucky. We've had Martin Sector and Nicola Bow, who are the junior team managers, that have come to those things as well. And Mal Evans, who's the director of coaching. So that's, you know, it's gone well. And I think they're doing it slightly differently this year, in that they're having an ID junior day where county associations can put forward names of coming under 18-year-olds. And I think they're going to take up to 75 children that day. In Leamington. So I'm not actually involved in that this year, but it sounds like a good pathway.
So I normally ask this of people who have transitioned from playing to coaching. Which one did you like the most, and which one is more stressful, the coaching or the playing?
Maybe transition is the wrong word, because I still feel that I'm at the very peak of my bowling ability. So whereas, I mean, I've been to a soccer match this afternoon, and Ipswich Town have won 4-0, so I'm in a very good mood. but I think, you know, with a lot of coaches, they go to coaching from being good at the sport that they're passionate about. And for me, maybe because I was a school teacher, I took up coaching quite early in my career. And I suppose that was refreshing, because to be teaching juniors who were only, you know, at the time, 9 or 10 years younger than me, was quite good. They saw that bowls wasn't an old men's game. And to have a young coach in those days was quite a novelty, I suppose. But in terms of stressful, I think coaching comes easy for me. I think if I hadn't have been a music teacher, I'd have probably tried to be a PE teacher, physical education teacher. I've always enjoyed coaching. I've coached a bit of squash and badminton and five-a-side football and things as well years ago. So I've always enjoyed the coaching side. But in that context, I think the playing is definitely more stressful.
That's fair.
So you've written several articles for Bowls International magazine. Mm-hmm. How did you become associated with that publication and become a regular writer for it?
Well, I did it a few years ago, just as one-offs, when Patrick Holbert was editor and ended up writing a section on leading for the book that he published. And then Sian, when she was editor, she just contacted me and said, could you write an article on tips for leading? And I think she was probably looking for a couple of paragraphs, and I wrote a couple of pages. And she said, oh, have you done this before? And I'd actually also written for an urban and provincial newspaper for 7 years. I had a double page bowls article every week for 7 years in the outdoor season. And so I'd had plenty of practice at writing, and as well as teaching music, I taught English. I've always loved writing. And so when Sian said, oh, this is good, I said, well, you know, I'll always do more. And ended up doing a monthly column now. So and it's great fun.
So Mike and I have been reading obviously the magazine, but also the columns that you've put out. And one of the reasons we were so excited to have you on the show was to ask your opinion based on one of your columns. So
yeah,
there's tons of talk about change in the game. Whether, I mean, there's a lot of talk now of things happening in the UK, but worldwide, Commonwealth Games especially, that Bulls needs to change, Bulls needs to modernize, shorten games, all the stuff that comes with that. And you wrote an article specifically on the fact that you don't see it the way that it's being kind of broadcast right now, that everything needs to change. Perhaps share your thoughts on that and what your article was written about.
Yeah, I think the introduction to all that really is that for anybody who's been in the sport as long as I have, you kind of build up this bank of treasured memories and also the nostalgia that goes with it. And I don't think I've ever been a kind of stick in the mud who resents change at all, because I think I've always wanted bowls to change for the right reasons, and particularly to look a more athletic sport. So I've always advocated that the colourful kits and the shorts, and probably, you know, I was saying that years ago when we were still playing in, you know, ties and white shirts and so on. I think that the blazer issue is a strange one, because a lot of the critics of various organisations, county and national, blame the Blazer Brigade for not wanting change. And actually, I don't know how much you two watch soccer, but you watch the Premier League football teams and they arrive to the games in blazers and ties. So, you know, I think whilst the playing kit needs to be as athletic and appealing and colourful and a bit of razzmatazz and to make us look like a sport, I think maybe there is a place for, you know, blazer and tie. And I know that Kirk Smith, the England manager, agrees with that as well. But, you know, maybe not at club or county level these days. But as far as the format is concerned, I think I was quite outspoken on that one. And there's a school of thought that says that bowls will only appeal particularly to youngsters if we play shorter formats. And I've taught hundreds of kids to play bowls, and some of them now are in their 20s, late 20s, early 30s even. And they've always particularly, they've just enjoyed the full-length formats, you know, the 21 ends of County Fours and Middleton Cup, which is our national inter-county competition, which is really prestigious. And the ladies' equivalent of that, the Jonas Trophy. And I think most people that play Middleton Cup and actually International Bowls still love the fact that it's a 21-end game and you get the ebb and the flow and the team that's behind, or the 24 players that are behind on the board have got time to make those tactical and strategic changes and to find a surge in form. And the long game suits that. You know, it's the only time really when you get that long comeback overall over six springs. So I think that's great. I also love short formats. You know, I didn't want people to think that I didn't like short formats. I think the formats at Potters are great, but it's done for time and it's done for television. Probably the only bit that I disagree with is respots. I don't like respots. I think you look at the best drivers in the world, the David Bryants, the Peter Bellises, respots have maybe taken that aggression away from the game, and it's become perhaps more scientific in covering the respots and things like that. But I think my argument was that there are some people that think that bowls will only survive if everything is short formats. And I think there's a place for short formats, but I also think there's a place for long formats as well. And to create this kind of myth that bowls will only survive if we play, you know, 15 ins or two bowl triples and things like that, or sets, is just wrong, because I actually think there's a place for all of those things. You know, I like bowls to be this kind of veritable banquet of different formats, where a bit like cricket, you know, we have the 2020 cricket, we have test match cricket, And I think there's a place for all of those formats. And certainly I'd be sorry if the long formats were lost, but it looks as if that's going to happen.
Yeah, like Daryl and me both are fans of the more purist traditional game where you can play the longer ones, and as you say, the ebbs and flow in a game where you can see a huge comeback or a like what 25-point, 21-point singles game where someone
Oh,
could be up
definitely.
big and then 20-20 type of a thing, and it
Yeah,
definitely has
well,
it.
going back to the Commonwealth Games in Victoria, I remember that was when singles was 25 shots up, wasn't it?
Think so, yeah.
And we adopted that nationally as well for, I don't know, for how long, a season or two. But I think those people who like the pure game of fours at we have a wonderful kind of variety of events to play in England. So there's a competition which is called the National Double Fours, which is exactly what it is, two fours. And that's 21 ends, and that leads into Middleton Cup and England Trials and the full six ring series. And those people that play Middleton Cup and the traditional six ring series, I think they just love that format. It's not to say they don't love the shorter formats as well, but I just think that is the purest game there is. And for me, I've played 101 games for England outdoors and 42 indoors. And I've been a lead in every single one of those games. And I've never, ever wanted to play anywhere else. But to lead with two bowls in a 21-end game for your country is just, you can't beat it. It's just the most prestigious type of format there is.
So one of the changes that's coming up, I guess, with Commonwealth Games immediately is they're changing the colors or having different set colored bowls for each nation. What's sort of your thoughts on having like the set colors and making that a part of the game going forward?
I think it's something that should have happened years ago. I know we've had self-adhesive discs and different colours and things, but actually, the sport has cried out for two, three, four players, or even 24 players in an international series. I mean, wouldn't that look great to have a six-rink international series with two contrasting colours? Yeah, I'm absolutely for it. It has thrown a few issues up, and I know when I was coaching the Commonwealth Games big squad before it was selected, they were talking about the possibility of this happening, and a few of the players are sponsored by Pensolite, Drake's Pride, Taylor, Aero, and saying that they might not get exactly the same colour, and some of the players are quite keen to keep the bowls that they've played with and done well with over the years. So I think there will be a few kind of teething problems, but yeah, as I said, I'm not a stick in the mud, and I just think that to have team colours would be fantastic.
Going along with the Commonwealth Games, how excited are you to have the Commonwealth Games in England and have bowls as a big event there?
Yeah, I'm just excited about having the Commonwealth Games full stop. As I've said, I'm just a lover of Commonwealth Games and Olympic Games, and I will be glued to, not just bowls, but to particularly the running. I just think that the athletics is great to watch. And but I think in terms of being fortunate enough to have a Commonwealth Games on home soil, obviously it puts bowls in a shop window. I remember when I watched the last Commonwealth Games in Australia, I've got the lasting memory actually of a lot of the Aussies turning up who'd been in the ballot for tickets for different sports and didn't get the sport that they actually applied for and got lawn bowls, and they absolutely loved it. And I sat next to some men and women high up in the stand who were probably in their sort of mid-20s, and they enjoyed everything about the occasion. They enjoyed the lager particularly, but they enjoyed watching, and they supported very patriotically. They supported Australia even though they didn't know what the rules were of the game, what the objectives were, but they watched and they soon got the hang of it. And And I remember hearing one of them saying, "Well, I can't wait to have a go at this." And that's what we want from Commonwealth Games on home soil. We just want people that have maybe not played or watched bowls before to have that opportunity. So yeah, it's a brilliant chance. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the exposure of Commonwealth Games is always a huge thing because, like, sort of as Gerald said, the facility there in Victoria, still to this day, you can see that it was a Commonwealth Games facility and then still being used for 20 plus years later. So it's definitely a lasting thing that has a huge effect on the Bulls Nation or whichever nation hosts it.
Yeah, and I think Birmingham is a very good city for the Commonwealth Games, full stop. I particularly like Birmingham as a city, and I think I think they will do it really well.
So one of the other reasons we wanted to bring you on the show is there's been a fair bit of, I guess, sort of an uproar almost about the British Isles test series and sort of the changes that have been occurring there over the, I guess, the last year. So sort of the big back and forth and every different country's almost put out a statement, it seems like, over the last few months about what's happening and what their role in the whole thing was. So we sort of wanted to get someone from the UK's perspective on what's happened and sort of how you think it's been managed so far.
I think it's as clear as mud. The first that I heard really was from Ian McClure of Ireland, and as I said, I first started to play for England when I was 23, and the Ireland team had a lot of guys in their 20s, early 20s when I was, and they so I've grown up with playing against them for years and years, and Ian McClure was one of them. And he contacted me and he said, "We've heard this rumor that the six ring traditional format is going to be axed. And what do you think?" And I just said, "Well, I am a true advocate and stalwart for the reasons that I've given of a six ring international series being the absolute pinnacle." I was 9 years old when I realized that I wanted to be an England international bowler. And that was my biggest ambition. And, teaching some of these kids at the academy and so on, their biggest ambition is to play for England. And some of them will do that. But certainly for this year, the changes made to the junior series, I don't know whether they're temporary changes or whether it will grow again, but it's been cut down to 12 men and 12 women, the juniors. And then the press release that we had from Bowls England the other day said that the six rink format doesn't mirror the Commonwealth and World events. And with World Bowls being every 2 years, there isn't a place for the six ring series. So I would argue that there is. I think there's a place for both. I think there's a. I remember the centenary test matches, and I played in those and really enjoyed them. And we played pairs, triples, fours, and singles. And so my view is that it would have been good to retain a format that's been in existence since 1903, but also to bring in the test match formats as well. I mentioned some of the other clubs, some of the other formats that we have. We have a competition called the National Top Club, which my club, Felixstowe Suffolk, has been lucky enough to win twice. And in that we have a two bowl singles, a four bowl singles, a pairs, triples, and fours. And you have to win three of the five events to win the tie. And it's absolutely great. It's a fantastic format, which I guess mirrors more the Commonwealth Games and World format. But I just don't see why we can't do both. So I've the various statements that have come from the different countries. I read the other day that Ireland and Wales had decided not to take part. I don't know if you've heard that as well.
Yep.
It's so it looks like just being Scotland and England, and that's a great shame, real shame.
Yeah, it's been interesting. My because I troll social media for posts about bowls and what's going on, but ever since I clicked on one of the messages about the British Isles, it's just been a flood of comments and posts and petitions and letters coming out from the various countries. It was sad to see that a couple of the countries said, if this is the way it's going to go, we won't take part.
I think, Daryl, you have to just, I think most international bowlers love any format they play. They just love the sport, and to play against opposition from a different nation is great at any point, whether it's junior or, I remember Catherine playing under 18 for England against Scotland and Wales and Ireland, and that was awesome. The standard was just incredible. My big worry about it going down to 12 men and 12 women for the juniors is obviously that it was 24 men and 16 women, because they played four rinks in the women's. So immediately there will be fewer places up for grabs, and that could mean that fewer juniors will say, well, we won't, or they will say, we won't bother. So, some juniors potentially could be turned off because they realize that they stand far less chance of meeting their aspiration, if you like.
So with this event being on shaky ground, do you see there an opportunity for maybe not necessarily the national bodies, but someone or somehow there being an event created to replace this in somehow, in some way?
I really think that could happen. I think the strength of feeling from certainly the Irish lads, I haven't spoken to any of the Welsh. I've seen some of the Facebook comments on it, from people like Robert Weil and John Price and people who are not current Welsh players, but they all say the same thing. It's just they've got so much sentiment and so much love of the friendships and the great moments. You mentioned the people that I've met. Yeah, I've played in an England team with the likes of John Bell, Tony Alcock, David Bryant, David Cutler. The list goes on. But also, to think that I've had the privilege of playing against, the top Scots like Willie Wood, Alex Marshall, Paul Foster. Again, the list is huge. And the great Irish boys and the great Welsh ones, and the likes of Peter Bellis and Ian Taylor. I remember leading against Ian in the Commonwealth Games. And people on the world stage, and that's come from leading for England with two bowls. My elevation into Commonwealth Games and World Championships was because the selectors deemed that I'd played well with two bowls in a six ring series. So it was a platform, it was a stepping stone, but it also was full of great experiences of playing with and against the very best in the sport, my heroes, actually.
I really felt it was a shame. Like, I've played internationally myself, and Team England, we bonded with pretty considerably when we were in Hong Kong. We had a young team from Canada with them, and all of them had gotten their starts like in that series. So I see like the history part of it is a huge factor that a lot of people are pretty up in arms about, I guess you say, the sentiment behind it. And then I think the one that I for me really is it's going to limit the potential to make that national team or make that leap to the national squad. You talked about it yourself, and we kind of related.
I described it the other day, Michael, as a conveyor belt. So if you take the conveyor belt that produces juniors, like Catherine, from 6 years old through to playing for their club and then for their county, and then for the junior national side, 18, under 18 indoor, then the under 25. Not all of those under 25 internationals will play seniors. It's a big step. It's a big step up. It's not, it's not a gimme. But there is a progression there, and I just think that conveyor belt is going to go very rusty if we're not careful. And it's a conveyor belt that will stop functioning if we don't give the aspirational potential to those juniors. You know, those juniors will want to play for England at under 18 and under 25 level. And if they're denied that, either because they're not quite good enough or because the places are limited, then the progression, I think, will just come to a halt.
Yeah,
That's
I
what I
think
worry
it's.
about.
I see it's going to be a way a lot of people might get out of the game, where you kind of start to that point where you're maybe starting to become elite, and then you miss that one opportunity or two opportunities, and maybe it turns you off for the rest of your
Yeah,
life. So.
that word's being used a lot, isn't it? On, you know, on the various critical posts of Facebook and things, the biggest criticism seems to be that it's making the elite more elite. And you know, in any sport, you will have the best players that are a level above anywhere else. But one of the joys of the Six Ring series is that if I play for England and I play against Scotland, I could be drawn against Alex Marshall, Paul Foster, you know, any of their Darren Burnett, any of their so-called top elite. And I think if we're not careful, if we go to smaller teams, I mean, there's a rumor that teams could be of six. There might be six very elite, and then a second string and a third string, and the second and third string won't actually get to pit their ability against the cream, if you like, of other nations. They would only be playing against a second and a third tier. So again, you know, they'll be denied that opportunity of saying, you know, I've played against a six times world champion today.
Yeah, no, definitely the exactly how I see it, and I'm glad I got someone else sort of, I guess I was talking about with Daryl here, and it's good to get another opinion in on it, because I'm the one who's sort of, I guess, been a little more closer to it, just because I know a few of the guys from England and Ireland myself, so.
To go back to your other question about do I think that other events might be brought in by, shall we say, a splinter group? I mean, that's what we're talking
I
about,
guess,
isn't
yeah.
it? You know, if let's imagine Ireland and Wales got together and they said, no, you know, we don't support this format. I suppose it's feasible that you could have a nostalgic, sentimental kind of ethic that brings about a six-ring series between nations, not under the auspices of British Isles Bowls Council or World Bowls, but maybe just a less formal, less funded international series. I mean, I played in the over 50s indoor internationals a few years ago, and it was great, you know, because you were playing against people that were not necessarily top internationals now, but had been, and they were people that you played against many, many times over the last, well, for me, the last sort of 3 decades, you know. So I think it, in some ways, it would be great. It would be interesting if it did happen. I guess it would be self-funding, you know, if it wasn't run by an organization, by a governing body, then players would have to play and pay for themselves, I suppose. But it would be nostalgic if it happened, yeah.
Yeah, things like that always come down to funding. So, but if people are passionate about it, I can see that being a thing. That'd be actually really neat to see if that actually that happens.
I think the things that we mustn't kind of take for granted are the fact that Bowls England and Bowls Scotland in particular have made changes that were sincerely due to COVID. You know, there were changes to our national championships last year with the length of games and the number of bowls that you had and that kind of thing that were down to COVID in terms of wanting to get 3 games in a day, and make them shorter. And then of course that was one umbrella, the COVID umbrella, but there's also the umbrella of the Commonwealth Games and ring space and calendar space. So I think what we mustn't do is to jump to conclusions and say that anything that happens this year will be forever.
True. Yeah, I think
so it's probably best if we just, you know, if we're patient and we hold fire and we don't fire too many bullets, and you know, we've got to say that COVID and Commonwealth have changed things dramatically.
Yeah, some of the changes to events, some of the events that just haven't gone on for a number of years, and not sure if they'll be back just because of funding and interest and calendar as well. It'll be interesting to see where everything falls after this year when supposedly everything starts to get back to some sort of a normal and
Yeah,
progresses forward.
and I mean, your opening question was about the changes to the sport, and it will be interesting to know if these changes do become life-changing, what the uptake will be, you know, and whether more people are drawn to the sport because formats are shorter and so on, or not. You know, the fact is that most active sports have been in decline for the last few years. You know, certainly golf and tennis, and along with bowls, the participation figures have gone down. I think it's true of a lot of other sports as well, which is partly due to people's lifestyles in you know, the times that we live in. But whether the short formats actually attract more people or turn they could turn a lot of people off what they've enjoyed for years. That's the big danger.
Very true. I wanted to pivot a little bit, and there was another article in Bowls International about you and your other passion outside of bowls. Tell us about your music.
Well, I was a music teacher in Suffolk schools. So Suffolk is a county that I live in and worked in all my career. I taught music in schools for 33 years, and I think, as well as having an ambition to play for England when I was nine, I remember when I was 9 years old, I told my parents that I wanted to be a middle school music teacher. And at that time, I could play the violin. I was having violin lessons. I was a self-taught piano player, a self-taught recorder player. In fact, I was lucky that I could just sort of pick things up and seem to be able to play them badly. And then somebody at high school said, "Well, if you want to become a music teacher, you need to play the piano properly. In other words, learn to read the music, bass, clef, and so on," which I hadn't. I was just an improviser and could play quite well without ever reading music. And so I skipped through the grades very quickly and went to piano lessons with a little old lady up the road, and had to have Associated Board Royal Schools of Music grade 8 and grade 6 to get into music college. Got into music college, had 4 years there. I'd also played in the Stowmarket School's concert band, which was a very accomplished band of students, and actually toured America and Canada, aged 14, 25 concerts in 21 days, and
Wow.
fantastic sightseeing, New York, Ottawa, Ontario, day trip to the CN Tower, Niagara Falls, playing in plazas and malls, and you know, it's just unforgettable, really. So yeah, I went to music college and then teacher training at university, and I've taught so many different kinds of instruments. I know the last school that I was working at, I was teaching not just whole class violin and a whole class ukulele and whole class guitar, but whole class keyboard, and I was teaching flute, clarinet, saxophone, cornet, trumpet, baritone, tuba, and violin in small groups. So, yeah, and composing has always been a love of mine. I studied composition at music college and churned out lots of stage musicals and productions and concert material for the schools that I worked in. And I still sing in two choirs, a very good choir, very classical choir, and one light music choir. And I play violin and electric violin in two contemporary folk groups. And then a couple of years ago, I had a great honor. I played with, you've probably heard of the Electric Light Orchestra, ELO. And I played with a group that's generally known as being the best tribute act to ELO, called the ELO Encounter. So I played on stage with them, electric violin.
Wow.
Yeah, like the article that we were sort of seeing there was specifically about your compilation album that you put out there as a fundraiser. So do you mind sort of sharing what that came about or how that came about?
Yes, of course. At the start of lockdown, when we could do really was to paint fences and garden furniture and make our gardens look good. And I was lucky enough to have my studio keyboard upstairs, and I look back on my teaching career and a number of the songs and instrumentals that I'd written for different productions, and I just thought, I'm going to revamp these on this keyboard. And it's a keyboard that's got brilliant orchestral sounds, the 16-track recording facility and things. And I decided that I would just revamp these things. And then my Catherine's little boy, Harry, he was one on the 29th of March. Most people don't know, but Harry was resuscitated three times in his first few hours of life. And I decided that I would make all these things onto an album, and that I would sell the album for the special care baby unit at Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, where Harry was born. So, and it's gone really well. It's over £400 now to go to the hospital. So, you know, that will be spent for whatever they choose in the special care baby unit.
That's awesome. It's great to hear stories like that. I think what you're doing is definitely very admirable, and we
Thank
hope it
you.
continues to go well.
Yeah, thank
One
you.
question for you. How are mother, grandson, and grandfather doing now?
Little Harry, aged one, has made his debut at Nottingham at the English Indoor Bowling Association Championships. Catherine had just finished the Eton Trophy, which is the national inter-club four rinks of fours. And that the whole green was vacated, and the Peter Thompson and Carl Higgins were just putting the tables up for the presentation. And Harry decided that he was going to stand up at the end of the ring and pick somebody's bowl up in two hands, and clearly wanted to get onto the green. So Catherine put him on, and he crawled onto a mat that had been left on rink one and promptly rolled the jack up the green. So he's pretty deadly with a tennis ball. He throws it for the dog at home, and he can roll it and throw it in the right direction with quite a lot of power. So I think the signs are good. He's made his debut.
That's awesome.
So just a matter of time until another Rednall is playing for Team England, I guess.
And Catherine is fine. Catherine won the National Ladies Fours with her teammates the other day, and the Yetton Trophy. So two more national titles.
Wow.
She's doing well.
So I guess did you have any other questions that you had today, Daryl?
No, that was great. John, really appreciate you coming on the show. We were really pumped when you said yes, you'll do an interview. For making the time for us, we want to get a global perspective. We want to get the news out to everybody, perspectives that are not just our own. So having your perspective on everything that's going on in the UK, talk about the Commonwealth Games, and especially your career and what you're doing has been fantastic. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It's great to hear what's going on in other countries as well, and what their perceptions are. And as much as, you know, social media is maligned in some cases, I said earlier on, you know, playing for England for 31 years, I've met some fantastic people, and you know, I have friends in just about every country that I've ever played against, I think. So they're Facebook friends, and we keep in touch, and it's just good to hear that the game is flourishing, particularly in the countries that you don't necessarily associate with bowls. You know, I was amazed at the Commonwealth Games in Australia, you know, just how good a lot of the smaller countries are and how cosmopolitan bowls has become in those countries. It's, you know, just a feast, really. It's a feast of bowls.
Well, yeah, thanks again for joining us, and I
My pleasure.
and we're back. Was a fun interview. I enjoyed that one. We had quite a good conversation there with Johnny. Fun that he actually was at the Commonwealth Games in Canada, so we had a bit of an interesting conversation there, being able to talk with someone who's actually played in our country, which was really cool.
Yeah, really, really cool insights. Like we were kind of saying in there, he's written for Bowls International and had some really great opinions, which weren't always in line with everybody else. Which you know, the current sentiment and repeated stuff is, you know, Bowls needs to change. Bowls needs to modernize. Shorter games, shorter this, shorter that. And he's kind of saying, you know, while he appreciates that and knows that that's a part of what needs to come, there is still a place for all the traditional stuff, which I thoroughly agree with as well.
Yeah, and like the point he made with when he was at the Commonwealth Games, it was round robin, 10 or 11, 21 end games. It's a heck of a lot more games than they're currently playing when you go to the Commonwealth Games. So you can see how much it has changed, even in what's it, t over 20 years since it was hosted, or I guess 26, 28 years since it was hosted there in Victoria. So quite a bit of changes, and obviously still changing. So it was good to get a refreshing, I guess, to get a take from somebody who was a little bit different than the typical ones.
Absolutely. It was great. And thanks, John, for coming on. Michael, you have anything else you want to bring up for today, or are we good?
No, I think we covered our bases there. I'm excited for the season to get going. I know
Absolutely.
you and me both have got lots of stuff planned, and coming out to, I got my provincials starting next month, and then I got WOBA to look forward to in July. So I'm actually quite excited for this year. It's going to be a fun to actually go out and see people again, as you're kind of talking with the camp, see people I haven't seen in probably 2+ years. So it'll be great.
Yeah, it'll be really good to see people. And we've said this in the past, and I want to say this going forward. If anybody out there that's watching our show that enjoys our content, if you have stuff going on that you really want us to talk about or take a look at, you know, big events, things going on at your club, changes in your province or internationally, if you have big stuff going on, we love to talk about bowls. So, you know, shoot us an email, you know, hit us up on social media and just let us know what's going on, and we'll be more than happy to talk about it on the show.
And I guess before we wrap up here, just a reminder that if you're here today, to hit that like, comment, subscribe, any interaction, we obviously love it. So any sort of likes helps us out a bunch here, and any subscriptions obviously is the main thing we're here on YouTube for. And if you're not able to catch it live, we are either on YouTube after the fact, or you can get us on major podcast platforms shortly after the show. Okay, so with that, I wish all your bowls be touchers.